Welcome to a new episode of the CCYSC podcast, Avaaz. My name is Tanu Biswas. I'm a postdoctoral researcher based in southern Germany at the University of Bayreuth. I'm an interdisciplinary philosopher of education, and currently I study the educational value that children's school strikes have to offer adults. And I'm here today with John Wall, who is in Rutgers at the moment, and it's a pleasure to welcome him. And we would like to have a conversation about childism. So, John, I would just let you introduce yourself.
Thank you. Thank you, Tanya. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm a professor in the United States at Rutgers University in Camden. In the philosophy and religion department on the one hand, which is my home department, and then childhood studies as a joint appointment there. I'm also director of the Childism Institute, and I'm delighted to be in this conversation with you.
So, John, let's just start with calling yourself a childist. You describe yourself as a childist. What should someone understand from such a self-description?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm happy to be called a childist just in the same way that I'm happy to be called a feminist or an anti-racist or a environmentalist or all kinds of other things like that. And what that means for me is that in terms of childism, that I think it's important to challenge children's historical marginalization and do that by critiquing and transforming social and scholarly norms. So it's a critical approach or lens to changing fundamental ideas and norms to include children. So I see that as, on the one hand, kind of deconstructive of patriarchy, which is the rule of the pater, who's not just male but also adult, but at the same time also reconstructing assumptions in response to children's lived experiences. So, you know, it's a way of coming up with new concepts, the way that feminism and queer theory and other movements have developed new ideas that can be used broadly, whether you're talking about any age or not, or children or not. What would you say? What do you think? How would you define childism?
I think when I say I'm a childist, I mean, like you, it's not the only thing I am, but for me, it's become at the moment like an important part of how I understand myself as a scholar. And when I say that, what I mean is that I've started looking at the world more from an intergenerational point of view, but not so much from the adult side, but looking at intergenerationality from the side of children and childhood. I try to identify how children and youth are marginalized or discriminated, both at structural levels, but also at micro levels. And I mean, currently I'm very, I also, in my work in education, I also try to understand what is the possibility, or, you know, what is the scope for adults to learn from children and childhood, because I'm very dissatisfied with this image of a child always being a student or a learner, you know, someone to be uplifted or raised, as if one can't learn from children. And this is also, I think, part of what I understand as being a childist. What do you think, what would be some of the key concepts one can think of in childist imagination or theory even?
Yeah, well, a couple of them. One of them would be an idea of humanity's deep interdependence. And I think that takes the feminist idea of relationality, of human relationality, but another step further to include the idea of individuals being independent from each other and fundamentally different, but also fundamentally reliant on each other. And I don't mean to say that children are the only ones that way. I just mean that looking at the world through children's experiences illuminates the way that adults are also that way and that humanity is that way. So deep interdependence, I think, is an interesting concept. And another one is a political imperative, where generally speaking, the political imperative is described as including the marginalized in power. But I would also add to that that we also need to think of that as empowered inclusion, so that it's not just left up to the marginalized to be empowered, but that there's ways in which others have to step in and continue that marginalization or continue that empowerment to reach out to each other and help each other be empowered, which again is not absent in other ideas. But I think when you think about, for example, babies being empowered, what does that mean? Well, it means listening, but it also means reaching out in some way. What about you? What would you say?
There are several I can think of. A deep interdependence, of course, I think that's also quite a distinct idea coming from childism. But I think ideas like concepts like, life not as going towards death, but starting from birth. This is something, and it makes a whole difference, I think to see life as starting from birth or enabling birth, as opposed to looking at it going towards death. And I think this would be one aspect of childist thinking. Also, newness or creativity, creation. Immaturity, ignorance, vulnerability, also playing, but like I said, not, it's a lens, childism. So this is not about looking out for immaturity in children, but recognizing it in ourselves. So just like when you said like deep interdependency, it's not just about children being dependent on adults, but we are also, we are interconnected. We are interdependent.
Yeah, I like the play concept. I think that's really
playing is, and it ties in also with creativity. But I have to also give another example, because when one says playing, and since I wrote on this as well as part of my doctoral research. It's not just, playing with toys or, playing hopscotch. I mean, those things are very valuable. But when I see, children going out on school strike, they're playing with the meaning of what it means to be, what democratic participation or informal democratic participation means. And they challenge our views. So we are playing with ideas through what we do. And I think it shows us a lot about how we exist as well, and what are the possibilities of breathing new meaning into existing structures, practices, cultures. And these are, I think, some of the concepts I can think of.
I think it's very interesting around play, because it's a way of being adultistic, is to say, well, only children play and adults work or are serious or something along those lines. You can create a binary opposition between unserious play and serious adult life. But I actually think you can learn from children that play is fundamental to human being. And we're playing now, talking back and forth and moving in between spaces and thinking creatively. And work is, play, not in the sense of playful, you might think of it in that way, but it's play in the sense of, as you said, trying out ideas, being creative. And I think everything we do in life is playful in a very profound sense. And we have a lot to learn from children about what does that really mean for everybody.
Yeah, we're performing roles, all the time as well, and how we interpret them. I think it has to do basically with this, the capacity to interpret life differently, what you do differently. And that process is on throughout you know, since childhood till adulthood.
I guess that ties, and that ties into what you said about newness as well, I think. To be able to be a beginner or a new thinker. Or,
yeah, and there's a lot to learn from children about that, for sure.
For sure. Well, let me ask you this. Can you say what led to your initial ideas about childism? Was it part of a larger intellectual or personal journey for you in some way?
Yeah, I mean, there are, you know, now when I look back, I think there's definitely my own childhood experiences did influence, you know, the my search for something, for an ism that was not, an ism that I didn't know could be, basically. And I think, I mean, you know, things like when I was growing up and the city decided that they're going to change the name, you know, and I remember feeling like no one asked me about my birthplace. I mean, it's my birthplace, and how can they just like change the name of this? And I didn't agree with these. I understood, you know, what arguments are being put forth. I would catch on to what adults were talking about around me, but and I felt extremely excluded, and I didn't feel like I have a place to say something, and things like this, or also seeing, you know, other children or lesser privileged children, because I grew up in India in a very populated city, and I saw so many children on the streets, and it started making me aware of, you know, my privileged, unprivileged position as a child compared to them. And that influenced a lot as well in terms of it was a deep injustice that I recognized towards other children. So these aspects were present for a while. And when I started studying philosophy, and during my bachelor's, I also, you know, was invited to teach children philosophy by friends I knew. And there it was, then I was in this teacher position. And also later on, I went on to work in kindergartens. And so from this kind of teacher position, or when I did jobs like, you know, babysitting, and I had contacts with children as an adult myself, there were several instances where I felt like either, you know, I could not accept or receive what they had to offer. And it was not so much only coming from me, but just, you know, the context, the framing of the context where I was. Because if you were in a kindergarten, there were rules to follow, you know, which were put in place by adults and not kids themselves. And I wish there were restrictions I wish I could overcome in order to learn from children who were around me, but and also actually give them the space to explore and in the way that they wanted. So I think things like this, experiences like this, of course, influenced me. And then, you know, I started doing childhood studies, and with the background in philosophy, the way I related to childhood studies was very different compared to, you know, colleagues who were from social sciences. And then I ended up in the field of education, and I think somehow this question of what I can learn from children has been a major impetus, you know, to be in this, find this direction, basically. What about you? How was it for you?
Well, I would also go back to my childhood. I was lucky to have parents who took me very seriously and asked, you know, asked me to get to think about things and get involved in politics and think about nuclear warfare and stuff like that, which, you know, and even from a very young age, my mother was very interested in philosophy and did an MA in that, and just would tell me what she was doing, you know, and then I would have an interest in that. So I never felt that as a child I shouldn't be able to have opinions and experiences of my own and engage in those. But one thing that happened, I think, that kind of took it to another level for me was moving to the United States when I was 13. I think when you move to another culture that's ostensibly quite similar, with similar language and so on, things jump out at you. And I felt a different kind of culture around children. I felt a kind of privatization of childhood, is how I would put it. Children are very innocent in the way they're socially constructed in the media and so on. But to be protected and preserved and kind of viewed as very special and innocent. But I thought that struck me as odd, and that's what made me start to realize, oh, children are constructed in different ways in different places. Mm-hmm. And as a then 13-year-old, it was interesting to try and think, well, why do I feel differently in school? Why do I feel differently in this situation, mm-hmm. because of my age? Also went to did philosophy as an undergraduate, and of course graduate student as well. Although I also studied philosophy and religion as a graduate student. Mm. I actually went into graduate school after being a social worker, where I worked with adults and children in different capacities. And part of what drove me into graduate school was burning out, in part, but also feeling that the issues facing these clients were quite structural, fundamental socially, and I wanted to try and understand what those were. I was being given sort of psychological tools to deal individually with people, but it seemed more systemic than that, what was going on, and so that really interested me. In graduate school, I focused primarily on phenomenology and ethics, phenomenological ethics, as well as hermeneutical versions of that. And that was helpful because what that does is look at human experience as the basis of analysis, not human rationality, which is what philosophers often do. So I started reading Henri Bergson on play, and you mentioned Heidegger, being towards death, but of course now I would add being from birth or something like what you said. Yeah. And I ended up writing a dissertation on Paul Ricoeur, who has a very interesting theory of play, and he views humanity as basically essentially playful, between playing with language. That's how meaning is created, in both a passive and an active way, or what I would now call an interdependent way. So I was writing my dissertation on that, and at the same time, to put myself to graduate school, I was a coordinator on a project called the Religion, Culture, and Family Project, which was a sort of liberal attempt to reorient the conversation around religion and families in the US, which tends to be dominated by very conservative kinds of voices. But I realized as time went on that we produced, I think, 21 books out of this project, some edited, but mostly not, and not a single one was about children.
Right.
It really focused on marriage, actually. It was primarily about marriage and things like that, and economics and gender roles and things like that. So that's when I started getting interested in children, and there were others connected with that project who were also interested in working more on children's issues. But putting those two things together, the dissertation and this kind of curiosity, made me sort of realize there's something here. I put it off on hold because I had to write my first book as a young professor when I came to Rutgers, but it nagged me in the back of my mind. And so that's why I came back in my second book to try and think. That's when I started thinking about these that's when the concept of childism came out as a kind of phenomenological hermeneutics that's formed in a more profound way, because there are feminist hermeneutics and anti-racist hermeneutics and so on, but I started to think along these lines too. But ultimately what happened is that they had a Center for Children and Childhood Studies at Rutgers, Canada, which is part of the reason why I was interested in coming. We had a very progressive dean who said, let's see if we can create a PhD program in childhood studies here. And it would be the first one in the country, the second one in the world. And for some miracle, it actually worked. Usually, that's very difficult to get anything to work at a state university, but they were willing to invest in that. And so I got deeper and deeper into the childhood studies field. But coming at it like you from a more philosophical background, unlike the others in the field, I was a little bit of an outsider. But I was going back to philosophy with these ideas about children and childism. And, it was interesting to some people. But I eventually realized that it seemed to me like a shift needed to take place in childhood studies so that it wasn't just like women's studies is, which is great. I mean, both of those are wonderful, women's and gender studies or children, child and age studies, but also had something that women's studies also had, which is feminism. So that childhood studies could have a dimension that goes out into other fields and challenges other academics and also challenges social activism around a concept like this. And I started to think of that as a shift from a kind of second wave feminism to third wave feminism, but for childism. So from at least to begin with, childhood studies seemed like a second wave feminism to me, where the idea is to respect children as equally agentic and participatory and with equal voices and so forth as adults, which is wonderful and definitely better than the alternatives. But it seemed like the next step after that would be, well, now how do children's diverse differences in return change the very groundwork of how to think about agency and participation, just like third wave feminism started to look at ways in which you have to challenge fundamental norms to gain equality, not just ask for the same thing as men.
That's right, yeah.
So, yeah, that was my journey.
But you wrote an article last year called From Childhood Studies to Childism. You wrote there that the field of childhood studies has sort of edge towards an implicit or nascent kind of childism. So what kind of scholars have engaged with what you would describe as childism or childist in your view? Like, what are these nascent childisms in childhood studies?
Yeah, well, I would first say that actually I think childism has always existed. So religions and philosophies and so on have always taken the experiences of children as a lens of looking at humans. So you could look at Krishna as a child god teaching about the universe, or Plato looking at children's unruly passions to say, no, we need to be rational, and so on and so forth. And an interesting one is John Locke, who I think his ideas about empiricism were based on observations of babies, that babies, you know, come into the world just experiencing things. And I'm not saying he's right about this. I'm just saying this is how the whole idea of empiricism that John Locke was the first one to invent came about, that you have experiences, then you order them into ideas, and then you create systems of those ideas. That's what he saw happening in babies and young children. And anyway, so, but in terms of childhood studies, you know, I think, again, we could say in a broader sense, well, childhood studies itself has a kind of childish element from the get-go, because it's in part, at least, an attempt to critique adult domination.
And
that's why it exists. But more specifically, I would say similar ideas to childism can be found in Barry Mayall and Lena Alanen's ideas about generation. I think similar to what you were suggesting. The relation between children and adults and the way that these relational norms need to be deconstructed. I would perhaps argue that there's also a need for reconstruction of those norms as well, but maybe that is part of it as well. I think you could point to people looking at politics like Mark Chan's Maria Rodot de Zarate, where they're critiquing the adultification of public spaces. And I think that's a very similar kind of idea. Again, I want to make sure it's not just critique, but also norm transformation, so that public spaces are imagined in new ways as well. Mm-hmm. And then the last one I'd point to is Hannah Warming's idea of child prisms.
Child prism, yeah.
Which is quite similar to Erica Berman's child as method, my research as well.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, it was Hannah Warming's idea to generate kind of a larger conversation about these questions. And that's what it started out, the idea of a childism institute, you know, that was eventually developed. They're more about academics changing scholarly norms. And I think childism mm-hmm. needs to have more the legs that to also get into activism as well as academics. But, you know, those are three examples I would point to. It's also worth noting that there are scholars using the concept of childism in areas all from political, you know, studies to pedagogy, ethical theory. There's actually a whole movement in biblical scholarship that's childist now, where they, just like with feminist biblical scholarship, they're unpacking the ways in which children have been forgotten about, and also the ways in which childhood serves as a kind of, again, lens for understanding what people were thinking in that back then. So, you know, there's the old literature, there's childist studies in literature as well. So, you know, it's been a kind of interesting, you know, this nascent childism, I think, is there, I think, but it needs to be kind of thematized and more carefully thought about so it can have the legs to move further. And I would ask you about your very new book from 2020, Little Things Matter Much, which you managed to bring out in a pandemic, but I guess that's okay. And I mean, as I understand it, what you're trying to do there is link childism to, on the one hand, pedagogical philosophy or philosophies of pedagogy, and on the other hand, this concept of overheating. So I'd be interested to hear you explain a little bit about what's the connection from childism to those ideas and why you wanted to put those in a book.
I mean, it sort of goes back to this, what I said before, that I'm very fascinated and curious about, you know, what adults and how adults can learn something from children. And this, it's basically my dissertation published as a book, and I was talking about philosophy education for children, and my search was to try to find a child-friendly method, you know, to do philosophy with children. But what I started discovering more and more was, again, there's this, you know, we're living what I call overheating, which is Thomas Heland Erickson's term to describe how our world is at the moment. It's our zeitgeist, where there is, you know, it's an acceleration of acceleration. Everything is, there's, it's more, you know, better, constantly improving, no upper limit. And at the same time, I started seeing that in the educational context, where you have more and more, you know, standardized tests implemented by, you know, organizations like the OECD, which is essentially, you know, it's an economic organization, but they are the ones carrying out the PISA tests, you know, so it's an international competition of children, you know, set up, like they have to perform, and now your scores are not just about how well you do in your classroom or your school or, you know, in an inter-school competition or at national level, but it's international, that you need to prove whether, you know, the children have learning competencies and capacities. But one has to remember, it's an economic organization, and more and more standardized educational testing also, of course, increases the competition. But for me, and philosophy was also being instrumentalized like this. So what I noticed is philosophy teaching or doing philosophy with children, it became like yet another, you know, competence that children had to develop. And the argumentations I was seeing was, you know, it develops their critical thinking, and then therefore they will do better at math and they'll do better at science and their scores will go up. So the instrumental nature of education and also covering philosophy education, sort of turned this, you know, child who has to always learn, it sort of shoots it up to another level because they essentially become human capital to feed the economy of the future. And there is no way, I think, with such a culture or understanding of education and philosophical education as part of that, that there is scope to actually learn from children as well. Because what I found was, you know, to engage with children in a way that we as adults can also blossom philosophically. Firstly, I mean, we'd have to, that's where I use the childist idea of looking at philosophy as play. And then you're not just restricting philosophy to talking or debating or using, you know, spoken and written language, which is, again, a very adult way of understanding what philosophical engagement means. You know, it's this logocentric idea. And the more I actually played with the children I was working with, I realized, you know, when you play, and here I mean like role playing with small children, you perform sort of these thought experiments in motion, and you in that small those small moments, you know, one moment you're Thanu, and then you're a spider, and then you're someone else, and this is not a table, it's an airport, and yeah, you know, things like you're playing with conceptual muscles, but it's not easy to do this because we've forgotten how to be like that. So I can't. If you just said, you know, stop, you're not Thanu anymore. You're a witch. I can't just go into that imagination because also for me, I'm thinking, but you know, but it's me. I'm Thanu, and I can't be something else. Also in a playful spirit. And for this, you know, tuning into things like this, actually, what I realized, it requires you to slow down, because what we need to also do is consciously make certain cognitive shifts to engage and learn from what children can offer us. And this is where I connected it with overheating, because you'd have to slow down. So it's sort of in order to make room for the philosophical wealth that children bring in. We can't continue with school systems and education systems that are literally there to improve human capital, you know. And I have to point out, because very recently, the minister of the state I live in, you know, just before they made the decision to go into a second lockdown, he said that, but you know, the last things that were shut will be schools and kindergartens. And I said, because they also have a function to let the economy run. And he said, and he's like, yeah, that's, and it was very odd. I'm like, finally, you know, they admitted openly that it's not just about those systems are not just in place to educate children, but they're also there so that the adults can be on the market and produce and both are affected by this competition. They cannot engage with each other. And it sort of just breaks a very rich social fabric that could be. And I think that would be philosophically enriching for adults if they consciously make decisions to slow down in order to receive and give space to children to learn from them. So that was the connection that I was exploring in Little Things, Things Matter Much.
Fascinating, yeah. It's been interesting being in lockdown. I have a five-year-old with me, and so she's home from school, but they've got her in online education. And yes, I mean, it then becomes quite visible the way her education works is to meet certain criteria that have been established. So, she has to be on the screen for a certain number of hours a day, because that's what fits around adult schedules. Whereas when there's free time to play, that's really kind of a wonderful time that we've missed in some ways from all the time that people have to spend in school.
Yeah, it's also about what we miss out because of the way children's lives are structured, right? So it's like I mean, feminism didn't just liberate women, it also liberated men in certain ways. And exactly. I think childism, it's not just for empowerment of children, but also adults who would have the possibility to experience life in different ways. But coming to this term, childism, again, John, it's been used very differently in different fields, because what we're talking about is childism coming from childhood studies. But it's been used in literary theory, in psychoanalysis, in different ways. How are these different from the way it's been used in childhood studies, or the way you're using the term?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think there's really three ways in which it's been used alternatively. So there was one very brief way in a 1975 article by a psychoanalyst, two psychoanalysts, and what they meant by the term childism, and I've never seen anybody between then and the last one I'm going to mention ever citing that article. I've tried to find it, but it just seemed to come and go. It was in a pretty obscure journal, but they said, well, what childism means to them is it's a description of the way that children absorb, children are oppressed by their societies, both as children and as minority children or gender children or what have you. And then it's the way in which they recycle that oppression by becoming oppressive themselves, by learning to be oppressive. But again, like I said, no one ever took that up, as far as I know. In the 1990s, there was a literary theorist named Peter Hunt who developed this concept of childism as what he called inviting adults to read as children. And he was a post-structuralist literary theorist, and he wanted to find a way to respond to the way that children read differently than adults, whether it's children's books or not. But as people eventually realized, and as he himself realized, and he actually stopped using the term by the end of the 90s, it's very easy to essentialize children that way, to say all children read like this, and obviously they don't, and you wouldn't do that to women or men or minorities or any other group. So, it's important to think about the ways in which, I think, unfortunately, that was without using childhood studies, where in fact you could do sociological studies of the diverse ways in which children read, and that would be fascinating, and you might learn something from that. But he was just imagining how my children read. And then in the late, starting 2009, and then she wrote an article in 2009 and then a book in 2011, Elizabeth Young Brule, who's a psychoanalyst, started to use the concept, use the word childism to mean what she called prejudice against children. So she was
what we'd call adultism, basically.
Yeah. I'd call it adultism. I think others,
me too. Yeah.
Others for a long time have called it ageism. But it's kind of reversed, for children as opposed to for older adults. But her career had been in looking at prejudices of anti-Semitism and racism and sexism. So she was not herself a scholar of children, but she, at the very end of her life, she passed away the year after publishing this book, just applied the same ideas to children as well. And so, that's valuable in a way to say that there's a certain sense in which children are victims of prejudice. But my critique of that is that, it's a deficit-oriented approach. It's a little bit like a developmental approach in a way that it's looking at how children, what are children lacking that they need. It doesn't look at children as in childhood studies as agents with positive contributions to make to the world as well, including overcoming their own prejudices against them, including having prejudices against other people. What she's really examining is not children, but adults and the prejudices that adults have against children. So I actually think it's kind of ironic, because if you assume that children are only victims, then you're actually only further having prejudices against them. So I don't think it's very valid. I mean, I think it's valuable for pointing out some dimensions of the problem, but
yeah,
I think there needs to be a much more positive sense of how do you transform norms and respect children's diverse experiences at the same time.
I mean, I wonder if she was actually aware of Jack Flasher's work that came out, I think, in the 80s, and he wrote an article. He's a psychologist, and he wrote an article called Adultism, I think. And when I read this, it was sort of like she, because it seems like Elizabeth Yambu was looking for a term to talk about prejudice against children, and she used childism. Whereas, you know, adultism had already come into being, the term had been explained and used, but I wonder whether it was that she didn't know of his work or, and
I don't know. I don't Gillen know.
Wrote. Yeah, but I've always wondered about this.
Yeah. And it's certainly not him. By then, the word adultism was pretty standard coinage in childhood studies. And, but I didn't know that it went all the way back to the 80s. That's interesting. So it's kind of, it was a shame for me because I had just published, I'd been publishing since 2006. My book came out in 2010. That was my big book about childism, which was a year before her book about childism. So I now wish I'd called my book Childism, which I was thinking of doing, but I wanted it to be more subtle than that. But, you know, it's okay, but I think it's a little bit of a disservice. Well, it's unfortunate that it just misses the whole field of childhood.
To clarify. Like, that's always a clarification that needs to be brought onto the table.
What do you, I'm wondering what you think are some of the similarities and differences between childism and other isms? For example, childism and feminism, or childism and anti-racism. Do you think childism offers a critical approach that's distinct in some ways from those, or is it very similar in some ways?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've talked about some of this already, but I mean, like feminism or, you know, anti-racism and childism, I think what they do have in common is that they it is speaking from a marginalized position, you know, so their perspectives from marginalized positions. And it's also been for anti-racism and feminism, it's also been a lot about bringing these marginalized groups into you know, democratic processes in societies, like making, and I don't, when I say democratic, I don't just mean voting, although that is very relevant, but literally, you know, it could be decision making, basically, to make people's voices count, regardless of where on the social hierarchy or they are. Also, so childism also, of course, is, you know, talking about a group that is marginalized in several ways. And I think what they also have in common is, let's say, like the importance of affect, you know, to, or experience basically becomes a major phenomenon to study, to talk about, and to argue from as well, because before this, it's like the rational ideal was not just a male ideal, it was a white male ideal, you know, where reason takes over everything and is responsible for civilization and so on and so forth. But so I think that these are aspects that are common. But what childism, I think, offers, or the distinctness of childism, I think, comes from ideas like deep interdependence. Because, I mean, the way I understand it, feminism, anti-racism, they still somehow seem to talk about adult empowerment and women's liberation movement, the white women's liberation movements in the West. They were a lot about women going out to the market, you know, becoming autonomous, having more liberty. But it was about adult women, you know, and And I think there you could have, theoretically speaking and philosophically speaking, you could, with feminism, you know, be an individualistic feminist, okay? But I don't think with childism, given especially, you know, like deep interdependence, which is at the core, that we are, existence is an interdependent phenomena. This, I think, is one of the fundamentals of childist philosophy. So you couldn't end up in a place where the autonomous individual is sort of a part of the philosophical logic, you know, of thinking. And then, of course, not social logic. So I think this would be something childism offers that is distinct, that these perspectives, I'm not saying they don't do it. I'm not saying they're not, you know, relational ontologies are very important, even in critical race theory and in feminist, different kinds of feminist works. But it's not a must, you know. You could have in different ontologies there. Yeah. And what do you think it offers that's distinct? And I think I'd like to particularly ask you this in the context of politics and power, actually, if you know, what would childism, what the childist perspective would add to discussions and understandings of politics and power?
Yeah, I think that's a really crucial element to look at from a childist point of view. And as I said before, there's the patriarchy, which I think, you know, these norms of the rational adult male from the Enlightenment really were attempting to bolster a kind of powerful small cadre of white men on this constructed, you know, made up idea that we're able to be rational and all these other groups are not. And in some ways, other groups have managed to find their way into that political conversation in ways that children have not as much, although maybe they have. I mean, not to say that everybody, not to say that equality has been achieved or anything like that. But I think there's politics in the broad sense of human power relations that childism contribute to. You know, I think since adults have dominated everything forever, as far as I can tell, and much as men have dominated most things forever, that means that adultism infects language, culture, economics, families, communities, philosophy, just on every level, these have all been constructed primarily by and for adults, or at least without a great deal of input from children's points of view. And so in that broad sense, one thing I've argued is that feminism had this idea of a double bind that when women enter politics that they might face. On the one hand, they have to struggle for power just like everybody else, but on the other hand, they have to do so from a position of not being considered the kinds of people who should have power. So I think children have the same kind of double bind, but I think they also have a triple bind, because in addition to those two things, political systems are set up for adults to gain power, and children are thought of as pre-power beings who cannot ontologically hold power. And so children not only have to struggle against not being taken seriously, they have to struggle against not being considered the kinds of beings who could ever have power. Maybe, you know, that's one way to put it anyway. But you know, in a more narrow sense of politics, I think and have argued that childism provides a way to reconstruct things like what do human rights mean? You know, let's assume they're human in the in the true sense of human, as opposed to just the adult sense of human. What is a human right in that case? And again, I would, like you, go back to ideas of deep interdependency and things like that. The rights are not individualistically to be understood, but ways in which we connect in a profound way to each other and support each other. Ideas about globalization, how would those be transformed from a childish point of view? Justice systems, neoliberal economics, and as you know, I've written about voting rights as well. How would those be transformed? So, yeah, I think it's a very politics would be central to bringing childism out into the open and understanding what it means for children to be fully human and fully empowered, like adults. I suppose maybe one example that you've thought about would be climate justice, something like that. And I wonder if you would use a childish lens to think about the climate justice protests inspired by Greta Thunberg, for example. Is her leadership an example of a kind of a socio-political expression of childism, something like that?
I do use the childist lens to study this, actually. And, I do think it's a socio-political expression of childism, the school strikes and Greta Thunberg's leadership. In her life story too, it's very evident where she faces the power difference, you know. And this is, my estimation in progress. I haven't fully made up my mind on this, but I am leaning in the direction of saying that I believe that the first power difference we face or are confronted with is the child-adult power difference. You know, and sure there are intersectional aspects to it, like you could be a girl child or, you know, a male child. I mean, things like this, but it is, you know, it's a child-adult tiff that you and you realize that there's a social environment, there are rules, and they might not make sense to you. And you also sometimes think it's ridiculous, you know, it doesn't make sense at all, but you have to adapt and you can't simply ask why. And if you ask why, either, you know, you're dumped down or you're told you'll understand later or you won't understand and things like this. In Greta's life story, she was, this extends also not just to the family, but also in school, right? You can't really question. Although the ideals might say, yeah, you know, we encourage questioning and so on and so forth, but your teachers also don't, there's a limit to where they would want to be challenged. Mm-hmm. And she saw this, right? She said, she talks about how she was being taught one thing about the climate crisis and what needs to be done to deal with this or mitigate it at least. She was learning about the dangers of it, and then she saw the exact opposite being done by adults around her. And there is a childish response in that sense, because in that act of her exiting the very space, you know, which is like school is kind of the geographical location for children in modernity. You know, they have to be there because, as I also pointed out, there is a connection between the working hours or school hours, let's call it, of children and working hours on the market. And so, she exits the space that defines modern childhood. You know, school is good, children have to be in school. And she goes on school strike. So also there's a performative challenge to the system. So when Greta Thunberg or also her fellow activists, when they say things like, why should we be in school to learn for a future when there is no future? They are saying something about the educational system as well. And they're at the same time, they're challenging socioeconomic priorities of adult governance, essentially. So in that sense, it is a very good example of what childism at a practical, social, political level could be. And I think also it's important to learn from the youth climate protest. It informs childism theory as well.
I like that concept of power difference. I think it's very interesting. And I think it, on the one hand, it can mean actual differences in power that younger people versus older people tend to have. And it can also, I think, as you're suggesting, mean difference in a post-structuralist sense of difference from the norm. So the other thing that Greta Thunberg is very performatively and publicly challenging is the normative structure of power whereby children are not supposed to hold power, that they're not supposed to be powerful public figures. They're supposed to be learning how to be how to go into the public realm. So she's challenging that structure. And so I think it's very powerful the way she's doing that. And of course, not many adults have that kind of performative influence either, but I think it shows that this capacity fully exists in young people, just like in adults. There are some adults who have who catch on, but all adults have this have these capacities. And it's hard to argue after Greta Thunberg that 15-year-olds at least aren't interested in politics by nature. I mean, I just think they've also one of the new thing perspectives they brought, of course, is this idea that there needs to be greater urgency because they're going to be experiencing the greatest challenges over time. And so easy for adults to feel, or older people especially, to feel to not feel urgent about the issue because they will be gone by the time the really bad effects kick in. And it's not their own personal self-interest, But looking at it from the point of view of someone who has most likely a lot more years left in their life actually is a pretty profound change of perspective to look at the climate crisis.
Yeah, certainly.
So I think that's really interesting.
Would you if we again going back to the term childism, I think there are, I mean, skeptics or those hesitant to use the term might argue that the term childism reduces childhood to a singular phenomena, and especially the tradition of childhood studies and critical childhood studies, which is rooted in social construction and has right from the start insisted that it's childhoods with an S, and they can't, of course, accept something like this. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, no, I think that's a valid concern, but I think what childism is, what it's assuming is that we're talking about a kind of second wave childism, as opposed to what I would think of as a third wave kind of childism. So the same concern was raised about second wave feminism, that it essentializes women, and especially white male middle class women, and erases diversity in the name of feminism. And that's because the logic was to gain equality to some kind of idealized or some kind of supposed thing that some idealized male had, Whereas, but the way I think of childism is it's not like that. It's actually reconstructive or transformative of social imaginations. So the idea is to respond to the diversity of childhoods that are not currently having a place in the way society has thought about. So I think of it as an expansionist kind of way of thinking, that you're any form of diversity, just like in third wave feminism, that diversity, all diversity could inform common conversations that we're having, and people should feel obliged to interact with and change the way they think in relation to whatever children's experiences might throw up. And that ties in with also this other idea of childism being intersectional. You know, it's not that being a childism means that you're no longer an anti-racist or a feminist or someone concerned about queer theory or post-humanism or decolonialism or environmentalism. It's actually that these intersectional angles or lenses actually reinforce each other. So I think it's more like, so I just think that that's another way for childism not to be sucked into a kind of essentialization, which, you know, in some ways these isms all have the potential for that, but when they work together, it cuts that potential down. And at the same time, childism, when childism is not part of these other conversations, when, for example, anti-racists understand something like privilege without considering adult to child privilege as an element of privilege, they might not understand privilege itself properly, and they might not be as good at anti-racism as they would otherwise be, because age is a dimension of that as well. So, yeah, the idea is to undo the essentialism that already dictates the norms that we live under by expanding them. And I suppose connected with that, how would you say one might think about the global south from a childish point of view?
I mean, the diverse childhoods that are there, you know, picking up on this. I think, I mean, the global south is, it's a very, it's a blanket term, you know, to covers a lot of places. But if I think back before I wrote about pedagogical philosophy with children, I worked with child monks in Ladakh, which is on the Indian side, you know, of the Tibetan border. And when I was there, I was very inspired by, you know, how there were monks, child monks, who, contrary to the belief that they are always forced, and I'm not saying those things don't happen, but there were child monks there who, you know, they wanted to choose voluntary simplicity as a way of life. And this was one of the reasons they wanted to have that lifestyle. And they had other spiritual reasons or also social reasons. Sometimes just like they like the robes, you know, and they want to wear them. But they had in that culture, there was a lifestyle choice that children could structurally have. Because otherwise your lifestyle choice as a child is just going to school. And one should not confuse schooling here with education. You know, you can, I believe you could still have the right to education, but you don't necessarily have to go through a system that is imposing a very specific curriculum onto you for reasons that you actually don't relate to. And so that there was, I've been critiqued for romanticizing Ladakh, but actually it's just that I was very inspired to see that there can be societies that offer a structural alternative to children, which children in the West don't really get in that sense. I mean, you decide lifestyle after 18, you know, lifestyle is not something, before. You go to school and so you do. This childhood was very inspiring for me. I saw how they, you know, the society was structured. That was inspiring. And these are, I think that's something the global South, examples from the global South can bring into or enrich childism or the development of childism. There's also another example, since you talked about children, you know, holding power, because I when I was in Ladakh, I had the opportunity to, so these are really high mountains, you know, it's like You're out of breath very easily, and you have to acclimatize, and it's a very tough field to work in, especially if you've grown up in an urban context like I did. But I got to follow a nomad who lived there, a very, very old man. We walked and walked and walked, and then we reached his place. And there was a little girl there, and then they were concerned, and they started talking about how she kept running away from school. So they tried to enroll her into school, and she kept running away and coming back home because she wanted to herd the sheep. And she loved doing that. And at one point when they were talking about her, she just left. And I exited the room because I always had to depend on the translator for Ladakh. So I let the conversations continue, and I went out, and she had just taken off with this entire herd with her. And I was watching her, John, and she was, she was there. I could never do something like that. Like, she was there with this like herd of these mountain sheep, and the power I witnessed, in this, what one would call a child, it was incredible. And I was standing there thinking, I totally get it why she doesn't want to sit in a classroom.
Yeah.
You know, when she can experience this in that space. And I think this also relates to another aspect, because I'm often misunderstood on this, because enrolling children in schools is such a, it's also a political thing to get the numbers up. But there is this idea that what one could describe as an adultist idea, that the developed must develop the developing, And here's another dimension, I think, of when we talk about the global south, because the global south has always been looked at as this developing space, and there is a developed part that needs to now bring it up to where they are. Whereas, and there are similarities. And you also find this in Kant, like he compares children to inhabitants of Tahiti, things like this, where you see literally the parallels of how one looks at children and how Global South is looked at. And so from a very like a theoretical, at a theoretical or philosophical level, one could also challenge that placing of the Global South itself, as something to be developed from a childist perspective, I think. And one could do that by arguing for the diverse kinds of childhoods that are there, and there still exist cultures and groups where children have a lot more liberty, because they're not in school. They can engage, they can partake in social life, they can experience agency in multiple ways that the ideal schooled Western child cannot, because they will be their human capital.
Does that tie back in some way to the question about essentialism? Would that help you respond to this issue of the essentialization of childhood and in childism? But
I think there's an essentialization of childhood and childism, because it's an ism. It's not, childism is not giving a definition of a child and going from there. But you can't, when I say, for example, that for me, when I say I'm a childist, I like, for me, intergenerational interconnectedness, like that's a way I understand existence. It's a way I understand society. Also politics, like intergenerationality has become such an important aspect for me. And, no matter what kind of childhood it is, intergenerationality is there. I mean, children, we are, this connection will be there. And regardless of what kind of childhood you talk about. So I think aspects like deep interdependence need not have a specific definition of a child, Because one could also theorize about the definition of childhood from a childist perspective, right? You could discuss the definition of child from a feminist view or a Marxist view or a developmental psychology view, which is done a lot. But so
yeah.
no, I don't think an ism essentializes
Right.
a definition. You know?
It at least attempts not to, or at least attempts to undo essentialism. I think there's a lot to be said about the commonalities between post-colonialist and decolonialist ways of critiquing, ways of understanding, you know, humans and childism, because that they, I think what they share is a critique of this Enlightenment European male ideal, or falsity, really, of the independent individual rational actor. And they both unmask that as a power play and a means of oppression. And they, I think they both, well, like you said, point to this developmental idea as it's not like that's the ideal that everybody else should be developing towards. It's actually a mirage. And the whole developmental schema is problematic in some ways. But also, I think that this deep interdependence is something that has been harder for supposedly northern sort of constructions of the human to comprehend, because that's seen as perhaps weakness or perhaps childishness or perhaps feminization or something like that. And so there's a lot of support that can be brought in, I think, from a lot of connections made between those different kind of discourses. Also, things like this idea of epistemological diversity that decolonial gets at, you know, the idea that there's not one universal imperial form of rationality or knowledge, but that there's multiple sites and multiple possible sites of epistemological validity, and that again opens up the possibility of childhood as one element in what counts as truth and knowledge and reality.
Joe, may I have another question for you, and I won't ask anymore. This is the last. When your recent work has you're focusing a lot on children's voting rights.
Right. Yeah. Yes, exactly. And, yes.
Well, can I add congratulations about the elections in the US, by the way? Yeah.
Yes, thank you very much.
Yes. But tell us, you know, why has this become such a central focus for you?
Well, yeah, just to respond to that, if children could vote, we might not have been in this mess in the first place. But yeah. I don't know about that. I am actually stuck thinking about arguing that I'm writing a book about children and voting, and one of the arguments I'm making, but it's a sub argument, is that the current slide of democracies into authoritarian democracies, which you see all around the world, and not in the US but also in India, Brazil, Indonesia, Russia, you know, it's very hard to find a major democracy that isn't either sliding into authoritarianism already, or is toying with authoritarian elements, like in Germany and Britain and France and so on. So I think that when you recognize democracy as something that's deeply interdependent, as opposed to a competition of power interests, which is often viewed as, or as a development of a rational schema in that kind of model of democracy, then you're less likely to slide into authoritarianism, because you're more likely to recognize each other's vulnerability to your power plays and populism's power plays. But to the larger question, yes, I mean I'm writing a book which is arguing that age should not be a consideration in who gets to vote. So I'm deconstructing this notion of a binary opposition between adult voters and child and youth non-voters, but I'm also reconstructing what democracy would look like if it really was ruled by the people, meaning not just the two-thirds of the people who are adults in most societies, but all
the one-third, yeah.
The actual demos, yeah. A couple of things I could say. Well, let me just also preface that by saying we have a monthly meeting, which is a children's voting colloquium, where I and a number of other scholars and then a lot of activists who are both children and youth on the one hand and adult activists on the other are meeting to discuss these kind of ideas. And what we've discovered is there's a lot of arguments going on around why children and youth should have the vote in one form or another. But we've all been very isolated from each other, and we're realizing we share a lot in common. And trying to learn from each other and build a movement around that. But my basic argument, well, one way to put my argument is that the problem with children voting is not that there's a deficiency in children that keeps them from voting. It's that there's a deficiency in how we understand democracy.
Exactly. That
prevents them from voting. So that's a childish way of looking at it. You know, I'm not just saying children should have the same thing as adults. I'm saying there's actually something structurally and fundamentally wrong with how we imagine democracy at the moment. And part of that argument is to say that the way when other groups have gained the vote, which has all been relatively recently in the history of voting, that has not just been a matter of giving this autonomous kind of vote to new people. It's actually fundamentally transformed what voting means. So the first time that all adult males over 21 got the vote was actually only about 150 years ago in France. And it used to be just landowning men who had the vote. And if you go from, why would you think only landowning men should get the vote? Well, you think that only people who represent the space that they own should get the vote. And all the people who live on their land are sort of their political property in a way. And they're the only ones who have a stake in politics on that way of thinking. And when men gain the vote, it fundamentally transformed what does voting mean and what is democracy all about to heads of household should be the ones deciding everything. And they can then represent their dependents, the women and children in their household and these in extended families. And then how did it change when, for example, women gained the vote? And my argument is that it changed from someone representing a household to anybody who's competent to vote should vote. And the argument that finally won the day after many other attempts to get women the vote was an argument about competence. So that's when the idea became solidified that voting is about adulthood. That's when the binary opposition was created between adulthood and childhood. And of course, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying women's suffrage was a bad idea, but I'm just saying that democratic step cemented this kind of idea of voting as being for adults. But of course, that was only 100 years ago. So to cut a long story short, you know, I argue that actually children are competent to vote because the competence needed to vote is simply the ability to have political views and be able to apply them to the options before you, which is actually a relatively simple competency. I argue that competency is the right to vote is more like the right to freedom of speech, that it's something everybody should have because everybody has, as long as you do it, you can presume to have the competency to do it already. And it's not like other potentially age limiting rights, like to drive a car, for example, or to get married, where you could actually cause significant harm or damage to yourself or others in the process. But of course, that's all debatable, but
yeah.
I'm just saying that in the case of voting, it's more like freedom of speech than those other kind of things. Same with knowledge and power. You know, those are things that you should have if you want to exercise them, you should be able to do so. And then the other general argument I'm making, apart from children are capable of voting, is that they would be much, much better off if they could. It would be the single most significant advance in the well-being of children's lives that you could have, just as it has been for all other groups who gained the vote. Minorities, women, the poor, and so on and so forth. And not only that, but as also in all of those other instances, it wouldn't only be better for children, it would be better for adults and societies as well. Because adults and societies would understand children's political experiences in much more detail and depth because they'd be represented. So then democracy would have to transform from this idea of the attempt to form a rational consensus amongst competent people, which is the ideology that we sort of have at the moment, generally speaking, or maybe the attempt to have a competition or struggle among people's interests. That would be another way of thinking about it, the kind of neoliberal way of thinking. Instead, democracy would be understood as a representational kind of democracy, that the whole point of democracy is to put pressure on representatives to be as maximally responsive to the diversity of people's experiences, which is another theory of democracy, a more postmodern theory, where it's interdependent and empowering for people's diversity of experiences. Concretely speaking, I argue for what I call a proxy claim vote, which is a way of translating this kind of childish idea of democracy. Mm. So the idea would be that everybody gets a proxy vote at birth to death, mm-hmm. which the closest person to them, whether it's a guardian or next of kin or whatever, would use. But that doesn't just mean babies and young children, who I want to make sure are not left out of all of this. It also includes the 10% of adults who have severe cognitive disabilities, like dementia mm. or severe mental illness or severe hospitalizations, cognitive impairments. Adults too would have this baseline proxy vote that they could hand to somebody else to represent them. And then the claim side is anybody should be able to claim their own vote to use on their own behalf whenever they want.
When they're ready, yeah.
Whenever they want, they desire. That desire for the vote is sufficient evidence of your competence to use your vote. So if a five-year-old, as you know, many five-year-olds in children's parliaments are very actively engaged in the politics of their communities. If a five-year-old says, I want to be able to vote. You know, I want my vote for myself now. And they should be able to claim it without any interference from anybody else. Greta Thunberg at 15 would be able to say, one way I want to deal with this climate issue is to claim my vote. And I think that would be more democratic to have that structure of voting because it would be better for democracy because then representatives...
We expand the horizons of democracy. Right.
They'd actually have to be responsive to all their constituents to the same degree.
Yeah. It's a wonderful idea. And I look forward to talking more about these aspects as well with you in the future. But we have to bring this to an end now. But it's been lovely talking to you and exchanging.
It's been wonderful to chat with you too. It's so much fun to have this conversation. Thank you.
Likewise, thank you. And for the listeners, thank you for listening as well. If you're interested, please check out the Childism Institute website, which is childism.camden.rutgers.edu. Did I say that right?
Yes.
And you can, on the page, you can find the link to the Facebook group if you want to join it, sign up for the listserv. Thank you very much for listening to us.
Thank you for listening. Have a good day.